Hello, it's Katie Halper from Useful Idiots. Before getting into today's episode, I want to mention that our interview with the journalist Chris Hedges had so much good stuff in it that we've decided to split it into two parts. So we'll be releasing part two of our interview next week. Thanks so much.
All right, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
And we have a great show coming up for you. We have a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and a personal hero of mine, Chris Hedges, is going to be on.
Yeah, great guest, great get. Very excited to be talking to him.
He was a little less excited.
I don't know why you're saying that. I thought I saw some glimmer in his eyes. I feel like he was very happy to be here. He really likes you.
It was a great interview, so tune in. And right now, it's, as our cameraman Reed would say, it's content time.
It's content time.
Yeah. So
but first, we have some pre-content.
We have some pre-content.
Which can carry diseases, by the way. And that is that we are doing a live stream debate commentary next week.
Right. Instead of just live tweeting, no, we're actually going to be on camera. We're going to drink on camera.
Yes.
We're going to figure out some way to do it. So follow us on Twitter. We'll let you know exactly where and when to be. But Basically, next Tuesday, the show. So the show is going to be Tuesday instead of Thursday next week.
So it is that time of the week where we do content time and we do the four food groups.
Right. So it's Republicans suck, Democrats suck. Isn't that horrible? Isn't that weird?
Yes.
That's me first, right?
Yeah.
Republicans suck.
Yeah.
So I kind of cheated a little bit this week. I mean, Canadian Republicans count, basically.
Canadian Republicans. What are they?
It's the Conservative Party,
okay,
technically.
Yeah, sure.
So they got a big election coming up October 21st between Trudeau and Andrew Scheer, who is the Conservative Party candidate. And the amazing development last week was that it turned out that Scheer is an American.
Well, which is worse, Scheer being an American or Justin Trudeau doing, what is it, face? It's not blackface.
Blackface, yeah.
Well, what was he pretending to be? Was it Arabian
Aladdin,
Nights?
Yeah.
Okay, so
he's trying to be Aladdin.
Aladdin
so,
face?
So they're billing this now as the American versus Aladdin. And Scheer had previously criticized other people who had not renounced their dual citizenship with the United States.
Oh, what are the odds?
And so there's some great gotcha moments where reporters are cornering him, and he really lards up his Canadian accent in response to being accused of being American, which it's pretty funny.
How do you explain your criticism of Michelle Jean's dual citizenship when you hold dual citizenship?
I asked a question at the time about the fact that she held it, asking my constituents what they felt about that.
So this is a big scandal in Canada. It's like the ultimate in hypocrisy. And of course, he's striking back by doubling down on the whole blackface Aladdin theme with Trudeau. So
right.
Canadians are essentially as shallow and stupid as we are
right,
now,
yeah.
Which is really, I think it's great news for them. One last thing about that, which was really interesting, the Toronto Star did an outraged editorial about Scheer turning out to not be,
right.
He is Canadian, but he's also a citizen
dual,
of another
right.
country. They said, it's not like having dual feet, they said.
It's not like having dual feet.
Dual citizenship, it's not like having dual feet.
It's like having
I read that line like eight times.
What does that even mean?
I'm not even sure, but it was such
That's
an
it such
was
a weird thing to say.
Right?
Is that like is there some dual foot lob? Is that like two left feet, or they just mean like?
Well, I think the idea is you're allowed to have 2 feet, but you can't have
Is that maybe it's a Canadian turn of phrase?
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. The Canadians are
they're a weird.
They're
people.
Excellent people, but they're very strange. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's basically a Republican suck story, Conservative Party, and that's coming up on the 21st. So we should find out. It's going to be interesting to see who wins.
We'll have
that.
Them both call in.
So what do we got in Democrat suck?
We have Speaker Pelosi, who said that she is supporting Representative Cuellar, who is facing a primary challenge from Cisneros. So this is a congressional race in Texas, and you have an NRA donation accepting anti-choice, basically blue dog Trump ally Democrat run, and he's being challenged by a Justice Democrats candidate who's a young Latina woman. He's an older Latino man. There's nothing wrong with being Latino or older, but just so people know the context, because a really weird big narrative that people use when they go against the Justice Dems is that they're attacking and targeting black members of Congress, and like they're not, like they have as many, in fact one of the people they're primarying is a white person and they're primarying him with a black person. Not that this, I mean, it's just like they're not even lying well, the centrists who are attacking them. But do you want to hear this? It's,
sure,
it's kind of cool. Okay, let me just play this.
Well, you have a friendly incumbent rule heading into this election cycle, so that if any incumbent Democrat in your house is challenged in a primary, that you will default to endorsing the incumbent Democrat?
That's absolutely, that is the easiest question you could ask.
So Henry Cuellar is in the audience, Congressman Cuellar from Laredo, who is here and has a challenger in the primary. You are a Henry Cuellar endorser.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I'm very, very proud of Henry's work in the Congress, and I'm proud to support him.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So it's just a typical, like, kind of spineless blue dog Democrat looking out for each other, because this guy really is pretty centrist, pretty Trump friendly, and won't return the donation he got from the NRA. Which, I mean, I'm already thinking of like the people doing devil's advocate defending keeping that money, and you could have a kind of Machiavellian argument where you're like, well, I'm going to spend it on gun safety legislation lobbying.
Right.
He's clearly not going to do that, though. And it's just, you know, as much as she talks about like women, listen to black women, as much as she does that, actually her listen to black women is more of her Trump clap.
I didn't even
know.
Oh, I've
this
never,
is on Twitter. It's
meme.
Like, listen to black women or give your money to women. You've seen on Twitter, like the hand clap thing?
No, I haven't.
Oh, really?
Seen
all right.
This.
Well, and then, but I didn't even realize this. There's this other connection, because you remember Nancy Pelosi? This was the most delusional pseudo feminist take on Nancy Pelosi's response to Trump. When she stood up, she gave him a standing O.
Uh huh.
And she went like this. And people were like, yes, slay
queen. Oh, right.
Queen.
Yeah, she was.
She gave him so much shade. It's like, no, she stood up and gave him a standing O.
She had something in her eye, basically.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was so weird. Anyway, that was.
There's a whole subgenre of reading into facial expressions that's become like a news thing now.
Yeah, I guess, like, you have to do it if your politicians suck as much as
Arsu.
Yeah,
yeah.
You have this whole subtextual analysis.
Right. Yeah. Reading facial. It's like facial recognition journalism.
Yeah.
So, isn't that horrible? So what I've learned is from doing this is that the isn't that horrible stories that evoke the worst reaction in you have to do with animals.
Yeah.
When I talk about millions of people dying, you're like, oh, that's interesting, right? But if it has to do with like a fluffy cat or something
a little dog
with a flat face,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. Seals, you didn't like that either.
Or pigs. So they don't have to be flat. I don't discriminate. I just don't like cats. Or do you remember the other animal I don't like? Let's see how much you were. How seen I was and how listened to.
Oh my God, I didn't see
women.
You enough. I didn't listen to.
I wasn't
to,
seen.
No.
Sharks.
What? Sharks, that's right, because you wouldn't mind if.
Amy Klobuchar killed a shark.
Right, with a golf shot.
I'm pro sharkicide.
Right, yeah.
And Anderson Cooper is a shark apologist. I once heard him on the radio being like, they're really misunderstood. I'm not kidding.
Sharks are misunderstood?
Yeah, he has human blood on his hands. Shark bite human blood.
Sharks just want to eat you.
Yeah.
They're not misunderstood.
You know who they need to be the mascot for? You know which political campaign?
For Cory Booker?
Booker Buttigieg.
Booker Buttigieg?
Yeah, don't forget. Yeah, Buttigieg.
A little fighting shark?
Yeah, fighting shark. Yeah. An ostrich almost killed Johnny Cash, by the way.
Really?
How? Scraped his stomach with his claw. I know this from reading his autobiography.
I'm sorry, that's funny.
It is funny, right?
So, okay, just quickly, the story, the isn't that horrible story this week is 11 elephants plunged to their deaths in, quote, ravine of hell waterfall in Thailand.
Why? Why did they do
that? Wildlife officials in Thailand said Tuesday they have discovered the carcasses of 5 more wild elephants downstream from a waterfall where the bodies of 6 other elephants were found last weekend. The carcasses were discovered after the first 6 elephants plunged to their deaths at the Hau Narok Ravine of Hell Waterfall in Khao Yi National Park in northeastern Thailand. And we have a little clip of a Thai official right now who's going to tell us something important. And what he's saying there in that clip is it's unsafe even for elephants to go outside.
Right.
So stay inside
and listen to or watch useful idiots.
Yeah, listen to useful idiots, because even elephants can handle it out here. The world is just it's falling apart.
Elephants have really good memories, right?
They do.
So they must not have seen the ones in front of them falling.
Here, I'm going to tug at your heartstrings now.
Oh, no.
You know why they went over the waterfall?
To save them?
No, to save a baby
elephant.
It's like the ultimately horrible story.
God.
So 6 of them went over, and then no, so 5 of them went over, and then 6 more went over. And we don't even know whether more or more
for
have happened.
They could have more auxiliary elephants coming down the
pike. We should revisit
this
next week.
So wow.
More elephants died in the ravine.
I care about human beings. I used to not even care about animals at all. When people told me that their dogs died, I'd be like, sorry, whatever. I mean, I wouldn't say that out loud in my head. That's what I would think.
Is that what you were like?
Yeah. Sorry, whatever.
We should find if you were a friend of Katie's in your childhood.
Yeah, and I said that. No, childhood. This is like 5 years ago. And then okay. My parents adopted this cute dog. You know, when you look at a dog, when humans and dogs look at each other, they release oxytocin, the bonding hormone, more than they do with cats.
Okay.
And I'm sure more than they do with sharks. So for Isn't That Weird, we have, you know, Barry Weiss, our dear friend Barry Weiss from the New York Times. This is from Mondo Weiss, which is a great website. Oh, I just realized Barry Weiss, Mondo Weiss. They have nothing to do with each other, though. Just two Jews. So Barry Weiss has been making the rounds. I don't know if you've seen this. And she's promoting some book that she wrote. But earlier, this is from a couple weeks ago, but it's just too good to resist. She did an event at the 92nd Street Y. And she likened anti-Zionist Jews who support Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, the BDS campaign against Israel, to Jews who had surgery to reverse their circumcisions just so they can fit in with the cool goyim.
Oh, my God.
So here's what she actually said. So Jake Tapper, another guy who I'm ashamed to share a tribe with, he said, what do you think about Jews who support BDS?
It's not a Is that your Jake Tapper
voice?
Yeah,
it's not great. It's not very good.
What do you think about Jews who support BDS?
I'll give you an historical example that I've been thinking a lot about. In around the time of the Maccabees and the Hanukkah story, the Jewish boys, teenagers and young men, were so desperate to fit into the surrounding society, and they wanted to pass off as non-Jews in the gymnasium, where you obviously exercised in the nude. So they actually underwent an ancient surgery to undo their circumcisions. Oh. Don't vomit. This is real. It's really real, and the details are... The reason I bring that up is that the desire to be a part of the cool group and the desire to be a part of the group that you always thought was your home and the deep psychological discomfort of realizing it might not be is very powerful.
And feel a part of your foreskin.
Right.
I just made that up in real time. I'm very impressed.
Okay,
with that
I thought
line.
That was actually a thing. Okay.
No, I just added that on. Just the tip. Sorry. I'm really. But isn't that like a weird? She's like, I've been thinking a lot about reverse circumcision.
So supporting the Palestinians is reattaching your foreskin.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know if it's a foreskin extension. Foreskin extensions.
There, right. Some it's like foreskinoplasty.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A transplant or an implant. Or, as we brought up once, but I don't think it made the cut, which is so weird because it's so appealing to hear about. Oh, I didn't even know. I didn't even do that. I really didn't do that. But I don't know if it made the edit, but we did talk about that movie Europa Europa.
Right,
which
yes.
Is about
I remember that scene,
and,
actually, yeah.
So you did see it, right?
Yes.
Where he, in the bathroom, pulls down his foreskin and it's purple, which led me and my friend to create the hit song Europa Europa Purple Penis Opa, which you may have heard.
Yeah, we just talk about foreskin too much in the show
foreskins
already.
Left and right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of weird, right?
It definitely is. So that's okay. So we have the Canadian prime ministerial candidate is not really fully Canadian,
right?
We have Nancy Pelosi is abandoning,
fully progressive.
Not really fully progressive. We have elephants can't survive and are
they
dying because of
heart.
Katie, and something about foreskins.
Yeah, something about Barry Weiss and missing reattached foreskins.
Right.
That
right.
is her band name.
Right.
Barry Weiss and the reattached foreskins. Yeah. Speaking of Jews and body parts, it's
right.
time to talk about Bernie's heart. That rhymed. I did not plan that. I didn't plan any of those things.
So legitimately a major news event.
Yeah.
Because there's no way around it. It's a serious blow to Bernie's candidacy.
Heart.
Yeah.
And our hearts and his candidacy. Yeah. So, I mean, people probably know this. At first, we thought it was just a stent, kind of a routine.
Well, I didn't think that. But
oh, you didn't? You saw it from the beginning when you heard about it?
Well, I mean, they were trying to pass it off as a routine procedure
right.
or something that was, you know, like maintenance or something
yeah.
like that. And no, you aren't hospitalized and have to have a stent put in unless you have a major cardiac event, I don't think.
Really?
So.
I guess so, yeah.
And I think that was kind of a problem with the story is that a lot of Bernie's critics, you know, got a lot of mileage out of
right.
this because the campaign, I think, mishandled probably
yeah,
those.
They should have come out from the gate.
They should have just owned it.
Or Marty, an MI at least. Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I agree, and it's very hard for me to ever criticize Sanders or his campaign, but I think that, to be fair, no matter what he had done, they would have gone after him.
Yes.
But I do think that that lent an air of kind of like secrecy. It gave the secrecy allegations some legs. But you know what? I'm just going to say that's anti-Semitic. If you say that, you're an anti-Semite because of the
so we're officially declaring
that
now?
Secrecy of the Jews, yes. And that they're sneaky people and wily right. people. And honestly, I'm disgusted by anyone who has said this. And I'm putting you all on notice.
So if you think Bernie had a heart attack and
actually,
you hate
if
Jews.
If you think he had a heart attack at all.
If you're actually even listening to this yeah. right now, you hate Jews.
Yeah. Yeah. You should have walked out of the room the second I said right. heart attack. Or you should have emailed Rolling Stone and been like, why are you spreading these lies against Amo Bernie? I'm just going to use the anti-Semite allegation as loosely as people have used the sexism with Hillary and with Warren. Not that there isn't sexism against them, but sometimes it's overused. So
I mean, the part of the problem here is there's a little bit of a boy who cried wolf situation, because ever since Bernie announced his run for the presidency, there's been like a story once every 3 days. Should Bernie drop out?
Oh,
Bernie should drop out. And you can go back and look. It started really as soon as he started doing well in early 2016
yeah.
in the primaries.
Right.
You started to see a lot of these stories. But now, you know, it's just one story after another, and there's all this concern trolling going on in these stories. Bernie Sanders' heart scare, Democrats on campaign trail and House leadership maybe too old. That's from, you know, Chris Saliza in CNN, you know, how Bernie Sanders' heart attack changes the 2020 race. Sidney Ember, of course, chimed in about 6 seconds. Bernie Sanders has heart attack, his doctors say, as he leaves hospital.
Sidney Ember from New York Times. Who,
yeah.
This is my favorite part of what she said. Ready? I can find her writing. I could like hear it from miles away. It's such a clear voice. It's like this passive aggressive pseudo objective. Sorry, I've never heard her talk, but this is how I hear her talk. But if Mr. Sanders has until this week largely avoided questions about his health, he has projected an image of fitness as a candidate and has maintained a blistering schedule on the campaign trail. The spotlight is now squarely on him. The ages of the current leaders notwithstanding, many Democratic voters have expressed discomfort with nominating a septuagenarian candidate, a notion that some political strategists say Mr. Sanders' heart attack is unlikely to dispel. Okay.
They should use that voice to interrogate prisoners at Gitmo.
Right? They would just all kill themselves.
So Sidney Ember voice. Bring out the Sidney
yeah,
Ember
yeah,
voice.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is what I love about her line. Ready? Many Democratic voters have expressed discomfort with nominating a septuagenarian candidate, which, by the way, applies to Warren also, because she's a septuagenarian.
Right.
Newsflash. A notion that some political strategists say Sanders' heart attack is unlikely to dispel. You had to go to a strategist to find out that it's unlikely that a man's heart attack will dispel. Also, what do you dispel? Discomfort? Can you dispel discomfort?
What she means is many Democratic voters who I interviewed specifically
right.
to get this point of view have expressed discomfort with nominating a septuagenarian candidate, unless it's Warren. A notion that some political strategists, who I sought out
right.
intentionally to get this opinion, say Mr. Sanders' heart attack is unlikely to
dispel
whatever.
But yeah. What I just find amazing is the unlikely to dispel part. That's so passive aggressive. It's like people are afraid of older people. Let's just accept that as a premise, right? And some people think that his having a heart attack is unlikely to dispel that fear. First of all, I think it's an inappropriate verb.
It's kind of a double negative-ish.
Yeah. But how? That's such a dick move. Like, duh.
She's a dick.
I know. She's a dick. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I say that with nothing but respect. Okay. But who's the bigger dick? We have to have big dick energy competition. big bad dick energy competition between Sidney Ember and David Axelrod, who she quotes in this article.
So this is the David Axelrod quote. Running for president is a physical and emotional trial, and the presidency itself is even more demanding. While we all wish Senator Sanders well, this has to be a big flashing light for him. And given his age, it may be for some voters as well. I love how they all put it on the voters. Some voters.
Right, it's not me.
Yeah, this is sort of the classic sort of journalism. We can't say it ourselves.
Right.
So some say, you know, sources say we think he should drop out because he's too old and we didn't
right.
like him to begin with.
And they have to pretend it's for his sake, because if they're afraid of it, to admit that they want him to drop out for other reasons, they're basically admitting that he's a threat.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So but my favorite of the concern trolls, I think, is it's truly wrong to tell Senator Sanders to hurry back. This is Tom Watson, by the way, the co-creator of Hillary Men. It's truly wrong to tell Senator Sanders to hurry back. This has the mark of tragedy. Let's encourage a little more rest and downtime. We already know Bernie's message. Feels like this is taking the wrong turn. Lord knows I'm not a Sanders guy.
Even the Lord knows.
I know. But I'm very nervous about folks. But I'm very nervous about folks pushing too hard to get him back on that brutal grind so quickly. Although I oppose his candidacy, I think Bernie is a progressive elder statesman. Can we all live with the consequences? Fuck you, Tom Watson. Like, does he think he's fooling anyone?
No, I mean, the thing about this that's crazy is when Hillary Clinton had her stumble in 2016, the ethics of that story are a little odd because on the one hand, you can't really infer too much from a piece of video that just shows a person, you know, having a little trouble on a hot day. You know, who knows? The only problem is she did actually have, you know, a history. She had a transient ischemic attack. And she had
concussion.
Which caused a concussion because she fell.
Right.
So if she were to have any future problems that would be concerning, it would involve fainting, right? That was a difficult one to know exactly how to report. Like, I personally probably wouldn't go near that one.
Yeah.
But when that happened, the universal reaction among reporters was we just shouldn't go there.
Right.
Among other things, because the Republicans have been making a big deal of it for
amongst
a while.
Amongst non-right-wing reporters.
Exactly. Yeah. So the health issues are legitimate in campaigns, especially when you're talking about an older candidate.
Right.
And actually, I think it's probably true the Sanders campaign could have been more upfront about this. But I just, they don't always behave that way.
Know? So. I remember when that thing happened with Hillary, I saw the video and it freaked me out. And I said that, but I also said that in itself isn't a reason to.
Right. It's a piece of the puzzle.
And I actually think, honestly, I think Sanders' heart attack is still better than Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. Not better. Sorry. I don't mean better. I mean more electable against Trump. I really think that. And why do I think that? Because I think Sanders can always respond to Trump by challenging him to a one-on-one basketball game, which is an idea I took from Nathan Robinson, former guest. And I don't think that Warren can respond to, it's getting worse, the stuff about her. I mean, again, I'll support her if she wins the nomination, but I'm just saying, not just because I like Sanders, I honestly think he's the most electable one.
I mean, that would be some ugly basketball, but
you seen Sanders? He's good.
Okay, yep.
Oh my God, imagine Trump coming out with like a headband and armbands and
full,
everything.
The full on Will Ferrell semi-pro with the head with the 70s headband. Yeah, that would be bad.
So you're probably wondering, what does this Bernie thing mean for us?
What does this Bernie thing mean
for us? It means that I'm committed to taking on more of the share of the, carrying more of the weight, because as viewers, listeners probably know, I did offer to be Sanders' running mate.
Right.
I actually have been very derelict. I'm supposed to send him my resume, but all this means is that I'm going to carry more of the load.
More appear. You're going to have events in Peoria, Olympia, Washington, Fresno.
Yeah. And you're going to be there because you already agreed to work for me in some capacity.
Yeah, it's going to be a no-show job, basically.
Yeah, but you're going to
have... I'm just going to pad my...
So we're going to have to take the show on the road.
Excellent. Sounds good.
Are you really nervous? Are you nervous about his health?
Look, it's serious. There's no way around it. I think the thing is, the Americans have such a short attention span, and their ability to follow the news is so limited that three news cycles from now, people won't even remember that he had a heart problem. So, it's not like it was in 1988 or 92 when this when Paul Tsongas had a health issue in 92, he had to leave the campaign because of this.
Right.
Whereas that's not going to happen this time. All he has to do is look fine a couple of months from now, and it'll be all right.
Yeah, and do well in the debate.
Right.
And remember, Dick Cheney had three heart attacks and was the de facto president. So
right. All right. I guess we gotta talk about it again.
It being the impeachment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about impeachment. Matt, you have a piece in Rolling Stone. The whistleblower probably isn't. It's an insult to real whistleblowers to use the term with the Ukraine gate protagonist. Now, when you wrote this, did you know it would be as much of a release as such a shitstorm?
I didn't, I guess because I wasn't following how the rest of the news landscape as much, so I didn't realize that nobody else had really gone there yet. And so, you know, there's such total unanimity about this story right now that now if there's even like a little bit of pushback on this, that the sort of the entire weight of Twitter surrounded this story pretty quickly.
Right. And what's funny is last week when we talked and we had Pussy Riot's Nadia
Salkonikova,
we talked about how hard it was to talk about Ukraine gate with any skepticism or impeachment with any reservation, just from strategic reservation, not even ethical moral stuff, right? We separated those things out. And then, you know, sure enough, you write this piece and you are totally attacked and personally attacked. It's not just that people disagree with you. It's that people, you know, I love the way people attack you by comparing you to Glenn Greenwald. I'm sure that really hurts your ego. Very stupid, yeah, Glenn Greenwald.
You're
right?
you're just like the Pulitzer Prize winning Glenn Greenwald.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, look, one of the things that's happened in the news landscape, and I've learned to deal with it, but I think it's not a small thing. Like, what they do is there are all these words that are just sort of bad. Once they repeat enough that Glenn Greenwald is sort of this villain,
yeah,
it's almost like the Emmanuel Goldstein in 1984. Like, they sort of invoke his name to sort of scare people.
Right.
You're a Greenwald,
right? Totally.
And there are other things, like you're an Assadist,
yeah,
right? So, like, Tulsi Gabbard, you talk about it,
right.
Assadist, Putin. You know, there's all these sort of words that get dredged up. And what happens is people, it's not so much that it's like with me, but other people don't want to deal with it, you know?
Yeah, right. And you said that, right? Yeah, you said that people don't want to deal with this because this happens. And I mean, I think it does have an effect. Like, it's exhausting. I mean, I think that it's stifling. It's a form of stifling. But should we set up the,
sure,
before we,
yeah,
talk about the response?
I was really saying is, so when, basically, to go back, there are two types of leaks, basically, in the news. There's the unapproved leaks and approved leaks, right? If you go back in history, the classic pair is Snowden comes out,
right,
with his thing. And that's an unapproved leak, right? He comes out,
traitor,
and says there's a vast illegal surveillance program. Everybody goes nuts. He ends up having to leave the country, and it totally, you know, rips up,
right,
the entire news landscape. That's like an unapproved story. That's like not supposed to come out. And when those things happen, the full weight of everything falls down on those kinds,
right,
of whistleblowers, right?
Yeah.
But the intelligence community is constantly leaking to the news.
Right.
And these are not really leaks. They're really more like news releases,
yeah,
right? So an example is when Snowden did his thing, there was a leak, and Snowden writes about this in his book, where they leaked the contents of conversations between the Al-Qaeda leader al-Zawahiri,
yeah,
and a bunch of Confederates around the world. And the term was the conference call of doom.
Uh-huh.
And so what they were doing in this instance, they were getting bad press for having,
right,
an illegal surveillance program. So they wanted to kind of turn the news cycle,
right,
and say, hey, surveillance is good too. We catch this stuff, right?
Right.
So that's... That's
like a curated leak.
Yeah, it's a curated, it's an approved news story,
right?
Right. And so this is really like, you know, sort of officialdom saying, we're going to give you a little bit of the hidden,
right,
story, and because we have motives here,
right?
Right.
Right.
And so all I was saying was, there's a difference between a whistleblower, who's a person who comes out with something that is legitimately dangerous,
right?
Right, and is going to basically end that person's life. You,
right,
know, they're going to,
they know it, or
they're going to lose their jobs.
Yeah.
They're going to face prosecution. They're going to have to leave the country. And I sort of cataloged all the people,
right,
who've gone to prison. You know, the new practices. If you talk to a reporter about, you know, they'll charge you with the Espionage Act now. In this instance, in the Ukraine story, this person, you know, this is an approved news story, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that the information is wrong.
Sure.
It just means that this is part of an establishment narrative that advances a story that significant institutional powers are behind.
Right.
Right? So there is a significant portion of the Democratic Party, the press, et cetera, that is sort of pushing this narrative against Trump. So that kind of leak, it's not like a single person's outrage conscience. What I was really saying was this is the other kind of story,
right?
It was presented as this lone person coming out, and I didn't think it was that, you know. And I think that's a context that we have to have when we look at stories like this. And the instant reaction was essentially, you love Trump.
Right.
You know, so,
right.
Yeah, which I understand, because, you know, obviously, I got retweeted by Breitbart,
right,
which is not awesome, but it happened. So,
right. But, yeah, this is a real problem, like the inability of people to judge ideas on their merits or respond,
right,
to them. I mean, there are going to be times when there's overlap. Politics will make some strange bedfellows. And yes, when you write this piece, sure, will the right wing try to weaponize this for their own sinister purposes? Yes. Does that mean that you're the same as them, or that you're writing this for that reason? No. And, you know, it's like we see this also with war stuff. I mean,
this is a policing mechanism. And,
right,
what troubles me about this is, like, I mean, my take in this is not common or popular. And
right,
I think probably a lot of people who are, you know, are going to disagree with me about this. Like, I look at this story in the context of a lot of stories in the last 3 years that are leaks from the intelligence community. And to me, there's an accumulated problem here, which is why I'm a little suspicious of this. Not everyone's going to see it that way. I understand that. But if the immediate reaction is to be like, you know, you can't have that opinion or else you're this, and you're pro-Putin and you're pro-Trump and all that stuff, what's going to end up happening is the only place that people are going to feel like they can get their opinions from safely is going to be this continually narrowing little strip. And they've already, see already, like, oh, that came out on Fox, that can't be true. That this.
Right.
So now the only place that people can get their news basically is the Times, the MSNBC, Slate, whatever it is. You know, then you only have to police that little piece of territory, and you know, you can control the whole narrative.
Right. And it also pushes people to the right, because if people, this story and this perspective resonates with a lot of people who are not on the right. And if you're only letting, you know, you're lucky you have Rolling Stone, but if you're trying to shut those people down, people like you down, which we already know people are trying to do because they'll tweet at both of us, tag us, and tag Rolling Stone.
Right.
Yeah. And they'll be like, literally, shut it down. They're Assadists.
Yeah.
Then you are trying to push people like you, let's say, off of more mainstream platforms. And then where would you go if you want to be published? You know?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's why the news landscape has become pretty sanitized lately, but it's also why people like Joe Rogan are bigger than CBS practically. And those two phenomena kind of go hand in hand. Like, if you very heavily police what goes into what used to be the traditional news outlets, and then people are they're going to end up outside the margins, but the margins are going to get bigger. You know, and so
also it's such a great metaphor when the U.S. like revoked Snowden's passport, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's such a great metaphor. Snowden didn't want to go to Russia. Like he's so anti-Putin. He's so anti-authoritarian. Like he's not a particularly leftist, you know. And he talks about him in this new book he just published, Permanent Record. He talks about the northern-southern political spectrum. As opposed to left-right. This is such a great metaphor. Like, the United States forced him into the arms of Russia. Literally. He needed a country to go to. He couldn't go back to the United States. Russia saw a good PR opening. They welcomed him, and he went there. Which is, like, a great metaphor for what's happening here, what people are trying to do, right? Which is, like, they want to marginalize people. And then, if the only... Because if there weren't such policing and stifling of opinion... Your story would be like championed, or your perspective would be championed by people all over the political landscape, right? Because it does resonate with people all over the political landscape. But the people on the left, or some of them, are afraid to say it because they'll be called Trumpian. So then what happens? You only see it on the right.
Yeah.
And then you turn back at the person, you blame that person, but you're the one who's making the hostile environment, which prevents people on the left from sharing as much as they would.
Yeah, people now work backwards. They say, look, he's a Putin sympathizer, right? But, well, he's there because we drove him to the far corners of the earth because he can't be in the United States because he told us about an illegal surveillance program, and the person he finked on lies to Congress.
Right.
This is the director of the CIA, and that person's on MSNBC. So what does that tell everybody? Yeah. Talking about John Brennan. So So the message is pretty clear. Like, if you release something that's actually a dangerous secret about the United States, like, you know, they'll crush you in this country, and if you're complicit in it, you get a cable show.
Right.
You know, so and so that's all I was saying about the story, is that, like, you have to think about the whistleblower in that context, because everybody's suddenly celebrating, oh, you know, we have to protect whistleblowers. Well, we don't protect whistleblowers. I just thought it was an appropriate moment to remember that.
Right. Well, see, what's different and makes it hard, I guess, is that Trump did threaten to kill him,
right? Of course, yes.
So how does that fit into it? Is it because the institutions of the CIA, the intelligence institutions, aren't going after him, so that's what makes it different?
If this followed the pattern of whistleblowers in recent memory, Trump would already have arrested this person, and this person would already be facing 35 years in prison, like Thomas Drake. If that goes on to happen, people are going to lose their minds. They're going to say, "Oh my God, what a human rights violation!" Except we've been doing that already for 20 years. So that's all I'm saying.
But at that point, would that said person be a whistleblower?
That's what I'm trying to say. Is everybody is going nuts about what an authoritarian Trump is, and he may yet be. That may yet happen.
It's certainly not. It's beyond him.
This person is from the CIA, is going back to work for the CIA.
Right.
And the CIA already does that to people, you know, and I thought it was appropriate to at this point to sort of step in and say people who actually oppose the state, you know, on those grounds, they're already facing significant consequences. So it's all I'm really saying is this is a, as opposed to one person battling the massive injustices of the state, this is a fight between two institutionally powerful groups.
Right. Yeah. I think what's weird and people are uncomfortable with and they can't wrap their heads around is the fact that this is like the first time, I guess, that the executive branch and the intelligence state, which you don't say deep state. Everyone's like, you say deep state. You don't
the
even say that.
Yeah, the intelligence
whatever,
community,
the
whatever.
Intelligence community, whatever you want to call it, are not, are really like at heads.
Well, they're,
with each
they're
other.
Completely at odds. And again, that, odds, that's, yeah. That's part of the narrative that I think people, the context of this, like, you know, think about when Trump, before he even came to office, the four heads of the intelligence agencies, the, you know, NSA chief, Mike Rogers, Comey from the FBI, they present him with the Steele report, then they leak it to CNN. That's unprecedented kind of opposition.
Right.
So they've been at loggerheads from the moment Trump came into office. So this is a this isn't a continuation of an ongoing clash between, you know, it's an unprecedented clash.
Yeah, it is unprecedented, so, which is why I think it's, I think there's some people who are, really don't understand it. And what the point is that, when you have the executive and the CIA at all at odds, you will have the president going after someone, but you won't have the CIA going after that person.
Right.
And that makes, that is a difference, because in the past, that person comes at, from the institution that then, like, devours that person.
Right.
Or tries to.
Yeah, in the past, they've been together.
Together, devouring. So where the president goes, so does the CIA.
Exactly.
The president devours, so goes, so devours the CIA.
And just to be clear, this happened under Bush, it happened under Obama, so it's, it has nothing to do with, until now, it had nothing to do with party.
Right.
Now there's a schism, and that's all I'm doing, is pointing this out. But, you know, it's a fascinating story. It's going to be fascinating to see how it develops. There's two whistleblowers now, not one. And that was part of one of the things I was saying is, you know, is this one person? Is it many people? Is it a group effort? We're going to find out more about that, and it'll be interesting to see.
Anyway, well, someone else who takes a lot of unpopular views and a lot of hits is Chris Hedges.
Yeah, Chris is sort of the standard bearer for being willing to be unpopular and going against the grain. And so we're gonna talk to him. And just to preface this, one of the things I love about Chris is, like a really good reporter, there has to be an element of just wanting to zag when everyone else is zigging. You know what I mean? Like, there has to be the not just the willingness, but the desire to go against the grain. And Chris kind of has always been that person. He's gone to places that nobody else wants to go. And so I think he embodies a lot of qualities that are really, really kind of going out of style in the business. And so we're going to talk to him about all that stuff. We're joined today by a very special guest, the celebrated war correspondent, one of my heroes in journalism, Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize winner. He's going to talk to us about a whole bunch of stuff today. But we think we should start off by what you were doing yesterday down on Wall Street. Tell us about the protest, Extinction Rebellion, the history of it, what happened.
So Extinction Rebellion is a British-based group. It's about a year old. And it, I think, has come to the very correct conclusion that the ruling elites are incapable of reform. And appealing to their better nature is a waste of time because they don't have one, and that as a species, we're completely fucked, even if we stop all carbon emissions today, which isn't happening. And therefore, our last best chance is to disrupt the machine, to carry out sustained acts of civil disobedience. It's a, you know, Extinction Rebellion is a much more robust organization in Great Britain. So the goal is to really shut down the center of London, especially around Westminster, for 3 weeks. They shut down London, large parts of London, in April for 10 days with 1,000 arrests.
Wow.
And I think that's it. I think that that's the only hope. So I was with them gave, you know, one of my diatribes.
Yeah, tell us
in
about
front
your
of the
diatribe.
Stock exchange.
It sounded kind of like a classic Hedges.
It was, Yeah. Everything's a sermon. That's what happens. And
we should point out, we're going to get into this, but you were a minister. You went to divinity school.
I did.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I asked the question, who are these people behind me in this temple of greed? I probably lifted that from one of your books. We know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were the slaveholders. They were the robber barons and the railroad magnates that stole indigenous land and killed indigenous people and slaughtered the buffalo herds. They are the industrialists who gunned down hundreds of American workers who were trying to organize at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. They are the people who, unleashed the reign of terror against black people through black codes and lynching. That's who they are. And I went, and then I asked, who are we?
Right.
And where do we come from? We came from Denmark Vesey and Nat Turner and John Brown and Harriet Tubman and Malcolm and Martin and Eugene V. Debs, and we're often defeated.
Mm-hmm.
I closed by saying that I don't know if we're going to succeed, but these corporate forces have us by the throat, and they have my children by the throat. And in the end, I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win. I fight fascists because they're fascists.
Right, right. And you did this down on Wall Street,
yeah.
Right? The symbolism.
It was perfect. It was a beautiful set. Hopefully somebody filmed it.
Is the girl in front of the bull still there?
We were a little up. We were a little down from that, so it was right in front of the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
A lot of people had a die-in, and they'd splattered blood with holding signs to commemorating those who had died in the climate disasters, flooding, wildfires, etc.
She's my favorite neoliberal feminist monument.
The girl
in standing in front of the bull, which is funny because I don't know how she's going to defeat the bull. She's just standing in front of it.
Right. Like, she charge at it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great symbol in a way, right, of like the co-opting of feminism and activism by capitalism. But it's supposed to be like a lean-in little girl.
Right, right.
She's going to lean in for the last time, unfortunately, yeah. I just had Christian Parenti on, by the way, who wrote this great piece in Jacobin about environmentalism and Marxist environmentalism, and also how we can fight climate change without self-loathing, which is an interesting proposition.
How do you do it without self-loathing?
Well, he was saying that you reminded me of it when you mentioned the buffalo, but he was saying that human beings and interact with the environment, and that per se isn't bad. It's the capitalist interaction with the environment, and so we don't have to like make it man or humans against nature.
Well, it's the treating of the environment as an inert commodity that you exploit until exhaustion or collapse.
Yeah.
And his book, the name escapes me, which I read.
Tropic of Chaos?
Yeah, Tropic of Chaos. It's quite good.
Yeah.
It's a very good book.
Yeah.
Chris has read basically like every book.
No. I hang out with Cornel West. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's like, it always is very humbling because he has read every book.
Right.
And then chastises me for not.
What do you mean you didn't read?
Have I read Schopenhauer?
Brother Chris? Does he call you Brother Chris?
Well, we're close. He just calls me Chris, yeah.
Schopenhauer, sometimes. Do you find Schopenhauer funny? I find Schopenhauer very funny.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I haven't read Schopenhauer.
Really?
Or
not much of it. Yeah.
Huh.
Should I go read it?
You
should do a reading now.
It's so dark that it goes over into being funny, but maybe not everybody would think that.
Well, that's kind of like Kierkegaard.
Right.
Who I do
Who said it, Kierkegaard or Schopenhauer?
We could have a contest later? Yeah.
Right.
Okay. All right, so how did you get into journalism? Let's go back to your background. Your father was a minister, right?
Yeah.
You talked about this. So it wasn't your intention to go into journalism, was it?
It was my intention to be a writer.
Writer, yeah.
So
exactly,
I always wrote. I mean, for the age of four, I knew what I wanted to be. But I had this, and I published my first piece when I was 12 in a historical journal. It was the history of my father's church, which was very old. And then I published my first piece in a major newspaper when I was in college. In the Christian Science Monitor.
Oh.
You want to hear that story?
Yeah.
Okay, so
you were in Boston, right, at the time? Right?
No, I was in. So I went to college at Colgate, upstate New York, and I got a internship on the House Foreign Affairs Committee for the summer, on the Subcommittee on International Development. And so somehow, rather than answer letters, I got myself into a position where it was done during the Carter presidency. I was writing a case study of Gulf and Western and how they treated sweatshop workers in La Romana in the Dominican Republic, and they were killing them. They were shooting labor union leaders were being murdered, found dead in a ditch. And so I found this guy. His name was Sasha Volman. He'd been like a partisan leader in Romania during World War II. And then, so he was one of these European socialists who hated communism. Mm. And he went to the Dominican Republic and became a huge CIA asset.
Oh.
So he, you know, was fighting, quote unquote, the communists. But at the same time, he hated the big corporations. And he was in a hospital in Georgetown having some pretty serious surgery, like his gallbladder removed or something. And I found him, and he had all the dirt on Gulf and Western, and he gave it to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, just dirty, dirty stuff.
Wow.
And so one day I'm in the congressman's office. This was Michael Harrington from North Shore, Boston. And two guys in suits come in from Gulf and Western, which was all mobbed up with Charlie Bludorn. And next thing you know, I'm called into the administrative assistant's office, and I'm fired from my unpaid internship. And I go around and collect donations from all the rest of the interns and hitchhike to Miami.
Wow.
To go to the Dominican Republic. Yeah, okay, I'm going to tell you the whole uncensored version. And there was this very beautiful French-American woman named Jeannot, and somehow...
This is a movie, isn't it?
I convinced her to go with me.
Uh-huh. Wow.
But I honestly blocked out what my argument was.
Argument, I like it.
A year later... I had lunch with her. She lives in Boston, when I was on a fellowship at Harvard. I said, Jeannot, why did you go with me? She goes, oh, but you told me the congressman said I had to go. I don't remember saying that. I honestly don't.
Well, it's effective.
Anyway, yeah. Off we went.
It was civic duty.
Yeah.
Civic
hitchhiking duty. Through Georgia with a blonde ponytail. Not a good idea. And we got to Florida. Then we flew to the Dominican Republic. And she was a Baha'i and went to a Baha'i retreat. And... So I was going to go out and finish the work, the investigative work to write this piece about Gulf and Western and how they were breaking and murdering labor union leaders. And I had no money, I had no resources. I'm staying in a little dormitory for the Sons of Haitian Cane Cutters run by the Episcopal Church in Santo Domingo. I come out the first day, I run into an American woman who's the organist. She introduces herself as Camaño. I said, oh, you mean like Francisco Camaño, the guy who was a colonel in 1965. The U.S. Marines invade. Right. He goes to Cuba. He raises a rebel force. He comes back. The Green Berets land and wipe him out. He said, yeah, it was my husband's brother.
Wow.
And so I tell her what I'm trying to do. And she said, well, my daughter, Liliana, I was like 19 or something, who was in her 30s. Has just gotten divorced and
Uh-oh.
Is back.
Jeannot, better look out.
Well, no, she's off at a Baha'i retreat, so
I'm on my own. Good timing.
And she was a firecracker, this woman. So they lend me the family car. We go out there, and we are going to all these sweatshops where the foreman had these. They were almost the size of baseball bats and would beat the workers.
Wow.
And they were what were they that they were.
Well, they were. It was textiles. It was La Romana was a big sweatshop
right.
area.
But what were they beating them with? That were
like these. Like, they were like big truncheons, but they were bigger
okay.
than
I missed
truncheons.
That word. Got
yeah.
it. Sorry.
And at one point, they started beating on. I decided to take a picture, and that was it. So the goons start. Except that I ran track, and I was very good, and they couldn't catch me. And so then it starts to rain because it's right on the coast. You know, these thunderstorms come in like freight trains, and. And so I think her name was Liliana. She's driving up and down on the dirt roads, and I'm trying to get to the car before the goons get me. And she's screaming, "Don't touch him! I'm a Camaño!" And finally, I make a run for it. I get in the car, and we drive. You know, I think it was about 3 hours, if I remember, back to Santo Domingo. About 2 hours, we stop at this beer shack, and drink a lot of beer, and then come out. And it's the rain stopped and it's feral, so you know the steam is coming up from the vegetation. And she pulls me up next to the car and says, "Did I ever tell you I have a tattoo?" I said, "No." She said, "You want to see it?" I said, "Sure." And she unzips her pants and she has like a butterfly or something tattoo right there. And that's when I knew I wanted to be a foreign correspondent.
Nice.
So I published
wow,
it.
That's great.
Yeah, I published it in the Christian Science Monitor. But
did you publish the photo as well and all that?
No. It was the Christian Science Monitor.
Oh, right.
Don't
okay.
you know?
No, yeah.
Yeah, yeah they never talk about sex or death.
Huh.
Yeah.
Everything in between, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, my father was a social activist. He was involved in the anti-war movement. He was a World War II vet. He came back from the war pretty much a pacifist. He'd been in North Africa. He was very involved in the civil rights movement and the gay rights movement. And I couldn't reconcile the quote-unquote objectivity of American journalism. I cared about writing and loved writing. But I wasn't really objective about injustice, suffering, human misery. And so I did go to divinity school at Harvard. And then after 2 years, I kind of had, and I always say Harvard's where I learned to hate liberals.
We talked about this because you were on the team, right?
I lived in Roxbury.
Yeah.
So I was running a small church there in a very bad part of, you know, Boston, right across from Mission Extension Housing Project. And so commuting into Cambridge every day where with classmates who talked about empowering people they'd never met.
Right.
Or they liked the poor, but they didn't like the smell of the poor. So, and they'd all go off.
Clara Jeffrey.
Yeah, they'd go to Nicaragua and pick coffee for a week with the Sandinistas and spend the rest of the semester talking about it.
But they wouldn't cross the Charles.
Yeah, they wouldn't take the Green Line.
Yeah.
So I took a year off. I went and studied Spanish with the Mary Knoll Fathers. I freelanced, ended up writing stuff for the Washington Post, ended up absolutely broke in Buenos Aires, was actually trying to get a job on a freighter so I could work my way back to New York City, and the Falkland War broke out, and I was in Buenos Aires, so I ended up doing NPR, the Yorkshire Post, the Baltimore Sun. I mean, I went from like living on $50 a month to making $600 a day, and like all people who don't have never had money, of course, I threw away my clothes and bought like the most gaudy.
Yeah, the worst clothes you can possibly find.
And it was Argentina, so you can imagine how bad those were.
Do you have photos?
No, thank God I don't. I had a reserved table at La Recoleta discotheque.
Wow.
I developed a very expensive cigar habit.
Could have been worse.
So by the end of 3 months, I made a fortune and it was all gone. And I didn't even really buy anything. But I don't regret it.
To get back to how your career started, when young people ask me, how do you get into journalism,
I always say, don't.
Well, that's the first thing I say. Go to med school. Yeah. You can't go to med school. Just move overseas to someplace interesting, you know.
Yeah, but that doesn't work anymore, Matt.
It doesn't work anymore. That's true.
But
it did for me. It didn't in my day, right?
Because, well, you were in Russia. Yeah. I mean, because there were outlets. I mean, the Boston Globe had a foreign section. The Philadelphia Inquirer had a foreign section.
And everybody needed stringers.
Everybody needed stringers. So, I mean, I began as a stringer and then eventually was hired as a full-time employee. But that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, you know, when I was in Salvador, every network had a bureau, they had reporters, they had producers, it's all gone.
Yeah.
Vanished.
Yeah.
Up in smoke.
That was a way into the business back then, was just going to hot spots, you know.
Sure.
There weren't a lot of journalists who wanted to go to these places.
That's right. Well, that's the great thing. Yeah. And that was great for my career at the Times because all the jobs that I wanted, nobody else wanted.
Right.
Like when I volunteered to go to Sarajevo, the executive editor, Joe Lelyvale, said, "Well, I guess the line starts and ends with you." Which was great. So they don't want to go there. They all want to go to Paris, or they want to like hang out in Washington.
Well, that was natural at that time because it wasn't exactly the safest place to
be.
No,
it wasn't very safe. Well, 45 reporters had been killed by the time I got there. Yeah.
Right. But it was a great. There was a lot of opportunity for reporters back then because there was still this appetite to get the on the ground thing, and it was kind of a hole in the system a little bit, right? Because the editors don't exactly know what's going on. They still actually need the person on the ground to tell them the who, what, and where, and
right.
why.
And you know the great thing about it is it's called sat phones.
Mm-hmm.
Since you can't fire it up, they have to leave you alone. I mean, when I would like go out in Bosnia with my sat phone, I didn't have electricity. So I had 4 hours, if I remember correctly, battery.
What's a sat phone?
A satellite phone. So I would set it up. My photographer would send, he could send over the sat phone. I'd send, then we have to turn it off.
Right.
They can't come for you.
Right.
It's great.
So go and do your work, come back, give us something, right? And you kind of existed for a long time at the Times in this kind of weird gray area where you were on the front page regularly.
Yeah,
and
well, they need the people East. Like that. What they don't want is you in the newsroom.
Right,
That never works out really well.
Yeah. So we were talking before about the first Gulf War, and I think this is really interesting because this is kind of a metaphor for your whole career. Like everybody else was doing this new form of reporting, this kind of embedded pool reporting, right?
Yeah, well, it was even worse than that. So, you know, so the first Gulf War, the people running the military press operations all came out of Vietnam. And for them, the press was the fifth column.
Right.
What they didn't realize is that everybody was over there. This was a whole new generation, and they were all over there to lick the boots of the military.
Right.
Yeah. They just and lionize Schwarzkopf, who was a drunk, and et cetera, et cetera. And
Storm
the
and
army
Norman.
Was so clueless they couldn't figure it out. So they thought the press was the enemy. In fact, the press just wanted to do their part, which is what the press always does in war, especially at the inception of wars. And Philip Knightley wrote quite a fine book on it called The First Casualty, which is truth. Obviously, I speak Arabic, so I was not about to do the pool. I figured I came here to be a reporter. If I can't be a reporter, they'll throw me out. So I start going off. I got like a Marine Corps uniform, and because so I could go through the checkpoints and
wow.
Sleep out in the desert with Bedouins. I speak Arabic, and I start filing these stories, and I kind of shatter the storyline that the reporters, including the New York Times reporters, were feeding their editors. We can't go anywhere. We can't, and they got really angry. And so all of the reporters, New York Times reporters, I think there were like five of them, wrote a letter to the foreign editor and said that I was ruining our relationship with the military.
Because you weren't going by the pool structures.
I wasn't doing the way the pool worked is they'd take just a few people out and then they'd come back and everybody would write up what they saw and then everybody would sit in the hotel and write it. I mean, it was ridiculous.
That's what happens in campaigns too. It's
Yeah. So I never, you do campaigns. I don't know why. I don't want to go any near them.
But it's the same system.
Or it's like the White House. You know, people don't have to, who knows what Trump does. But before, you never had to, reporters in the White House didn't take notes because in real time they just would hand them what. The only advantage I could see from a distance of being a White House reporter is that you get to introduce your mother to the president. Otherwise, it's just a stenography. I mean,
right.
It's just the most, and not only that, but it's humiliating stenography. Yeah.
Unless you're Helen Thomas, I guess, right?
Huh?
Unless you're Helen Thomas.
Well, but look what they did to
her.
I know, right.
She was one of the exceptions.
But I mean, basically, they were reacting to Vietnam because during Vietnam,
in the beginning of Vietnam, people don't remember is that everybody went in to do their part,
right?
And then what people don't understand about the press is that it is, you're an exception, but it is largely a reactive force. It reacts. It's not a pioneering. It's not like the press told the truth about Vietnam. What happened was the body bags started coming home and public perceptions of the war changed. And then Walter Cronkite goes on the air, of course, after public perceptions have changed,
right,
to criticize the war. And so the latter part of the war, the press was free to write honestly about the war, or at least not completely honest, but more honest.
Yeah, they were at least allowed to take this, we might not win this, right?
Well, they also covered atrocities.
Agent Orange. I mean, they got around to that, right?
Yeah. I mean, now Nick Turse did a good book, Kill Anything That Moves, which goes back and looks at the army records, the reports. So, I mean, Vietnam was just one huge atrocity. I mean, they didn't begin to come close to explaining the reality, but at least they hinted at it. That they weren't doing at the beginning. So the army, you know, these people who would have been young lieutenants or something bought this line, the stabbed in the back theory, you know, that we would have won the war, but for, yeah. And so that was the funny part, is that they were making war on a press. I mean, the whole pool system was administered by my colleagues, and it couldn't have functioned without them. And they administered it because, despite what they told their editors, they wanted it. And having spent 20 years in war zones, I can tell you only about 10 or 15% of reporters really want to go out.
Right.
The rest don't. They're handout. They get handouts. That's the honest people in war are photographers, and they also have the highest casualty rate because they have to get out.
Right.
But the reporters, they're...
You think that that system, and I'm sorry to dwell on this, but I just find it so interesting. Part of it seems to me, I was embedded in the Iraq war, and it felt like part of the strategy there was to make you feel dependent upon the people you're embedded with.
No, it's like a Boy Scout. It's like you're weak with Boy Scouts.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And, of course, most of these reporters have never been anywhere near a war and are, like, shitting their pants. And they want to be part of the team. Yeah, it's really... Yeah. It really, unfortunately, feeds every stereotype of wimpy journalists. Now, by the time I got to the Gulf, I'd already been in more combat than anybody who, unless they'd been in Vietnam. Those people were all colonels and up. And I spoke the language, and so I didn't need it, and I didn't want it. And but once you depend on them for logistics, once you depend on them for security, food, I mean, literally every aspect, what are you going to write?
Right.
I mean,
I know
reporters who were embedded in units after they took Baghdad, and a lot of these cars, they were nervous. So, you know, if a car would come too quickly at a checkpoint, they'd quote unquote light it up, which meant,
right.
And it usually meant they just killed a family of six or something.
Right.
These reporters never wrote that. I mean, I'm not going to name them, but I know who they are. They told me. Because they'd instantly be unembedded.
Right.
And that's the first problem. The second problem is that you only see the war from the perspective, their perspective. So they're off, you know, firing 90 millimeter tank rounds at a village. You don't see the result.
Right.
And I'm not actually against embedding. I think it is an aspect of war reporting. But when that's the only war reporting, then you don't have a clue as to what's going on.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you think it should be like you should alternate sides? Or
no, I don't
want to
do it. I don't embed.
No, but I mean, what do you think the
no?
Good
I think
way
you
got to
have people.
Is.
Well, so when I went out on my own, Dick Cheney was the defense secretary, and they invented this term for people like me called the unilaterals, a new term for being a reporter. And before the invasion of Kuwait, Cheney sent out a list of like. I think it wasn't a long list, 10 or 15 of us, that he wanted expelled from Saudi Arabia before the invasion. And I was right up at the top.
That's a badge of honor.
Yeah, the funny part is they couldn't find me. They had like 500,000 troops, and they never found me.
But when you say that you don't think embedding is bad, so how is it that...
I think it's an aspect of the war, but almost a tangential one. So you're always going to have reporters that want to embed. That's fine. But you can't cover a war when your entire, all of the reporting on that war is done by embedded reporters. You don't really know what's going on.
So ideally you would have, let's say, imagining that newspapers still kind of...
Well, you'd have reporters
budgets,
who are out
have,
on their own. It's more dangerous. I mean, it's obviously more dangerous.
So would one paper have, ideally, one paper would have someone embedded, someone on their own, someone embedded with the actual native population or indigenous there? Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
So you went on, you were based in Cairo for a while after that,
yeah,
right?
4 years.
4 years.
How did you learn Arabic?
So I was with the Dallas Morning News in Central America, and I decided I wanted to spend the rest of my life in Latin America. It's a wonderful culture. I speak Spanish. But I couldn't get them to open a bureau in South America, so they offered me London or Jerusalem. I didn't want to go to London, cover the
Big
royal
Ben.
Family or something. So I said I would go to Jerusalem if I could take a sabbatical and study Arabic.
Oh, that's cool.
And I convinced the editors of the Dallas Morning News that the best place to study Arabic was that great center of Arabic learning, Switzerland.
Oh.
So I went to Lausanne and studied Arabic. My first wife was Swiss. And then I later took courses at Hebrew University. Yeah.
And plus it enriches your Spanish because of all the AL words that have Arabic roots.
Yeah, there you go.
And lastly, I guess we should ask about the impeachment drama. You had a fascinating go back and forth on Democracy Now! Last week. I think we actually may disagree on this one a little bit, but what's your take on this? Because I think it's a complicated story, obviously. To me, it's basically a story about dueling elite narratives,
of course,
right?
It is. Yeah, because neither party has defended the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
From the first week Trump was in office, you could have impeached him on the Emoluments Clause alone, inciting racism, using tax laws to go after his political enemies, Bezos, who's a shit at Amazon, obstructing. Justice. Mm-hmm. I mean, obstruction, which the Mueller report, was a kind of Trojan horse. But he did try to obstruct justice.
Yeah, I think you could.
Yeah.
So,
but none of that mattered until you touched the anointed candidate of the Democratic Party donor class, which was Biden.
Right.
So, in that sense, it's like Watergate.
Right.
So, all of the crimes the Nixon White House are being carried out against the anti-war movement, the peace movement, and Ellsberg's
Cambodians,
Cambodia. But as soon as you touch the Democratic establishment, then.
Right.
And that's what's happened. I mean, they may get him. Mm-hmm. They may get him. But as I wrote a piece called "The Problem with Impeachment," it's probably going to make things worse.
Right. That's
because the fundamental structures of our society, which have destroyed our democracy, the system of legalized bribery and corporate money, the collapse of the courts in the service of corporate power, wholly owned subsidiaries, the degradation and disintegration of the media as an effective force within a democracy, the wholesale security and surveillance state, the concentration of wealth and staggering social, none of that is going to change.
Right.
And that's where our problems come from. And so if you go after Trump and you don't address the underlying decay that gave us Trump, then you are going to exacerbate the antagonisms within the warring tribes. And look, we are headed towards, I think, political violence. And, you know, Cesar Sayoc, if those pipe bombs had gone off, you would have decapitated right. the entire Democratic Party leadership. So, and the country's awash, 300 million weapons, 1.5 right. million, you know, assault-style weapons, these AR-15s. Yeah, I mean, we have an average of a mass shooting every day. So I think that the liberal class and the Democrats see this as you know, the solution. They've personified right. all of their problems into Trump. And that's not only very short-sighted, but very dangerous.
Right. And why do you think they didn't go after him with the emoluments clause?
We know why. I mean, because Pelosi didn't think it was politically expedient.
But I guess the question is, why was that not politically expedient?
Well, because you have blue dog Democrats. You have all sorts of Democrats who are essentially, you know, by thin margins,
right.
taking seats in Trump territory. And if the Democratic Party is seen as essentially trying to carry out a vendetta against Trump, I think this is the reasoning of Pelosi and the Democratic Party leadership. This would hurt their ability to maintain control of the House and perhaps take control of the Senate. So we know what her decision was, but that's as bad as the Republicans. Neither party is defending the rule of law.
Right.
They only defend the rule of law when it's convenient.
And then I guess this will give people the illusion of political protest a little bit. Uh-huh. You know, like it's going to be this enormous drama. All their political energy is going to go into this thing that's not really about, you
right.
know.
Right.
But even best case scenario for them, what happens, right? Like, do they think that the impeachment vote is going to go through?
Well, that's there are legends now. A lot of the op-ed pieces are basically saying, you never know. It's getting more popular, so we might actually get to the 2/3.
Yeah. And even if that happens, then what happens? Then Pence, if he's...
Well, as Noam Chomsky points out, Pence will be worse.
Because,
Donald Trump has no ideology, really.
And but he's Pence galvanized does. So much Pence opposition.
Comes as, Pence is a Christian fascist.
Right. But he's not rude. He's polite.
He's a lot more dangerous than
that. No, I know. So I don't even know what the end game is.
They don't know what the end game is either. That's the problem. Right. They don't know what the end game is either.
Ratings. Chris, thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. And a great, great free-ranging discussion. And good luck.
Wow. What a legend. That was great. I didn't know what Gulf and Western was.
Gulf and Western?
Yeah.
What is Gulf and Western?
Oh, you didn't either. It's like a manufacturer. He was talking about being the Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought this was an age thing. I mean, we're basically the same age, you and I.
No. Well, I wish we were. Yeah.
You're like, I wish you were older, Katie, because you're pretty immature.
So we have some housekeeping.
Yeah, we're doing something very exciting. You guys may know that I'm very famous for my drinking games
on
Twitter.
Your debate night drinking games?
No, Matt, you have one of the things that you're most well known for, I think, is besides your amazing books and reporting, is that you have these drinking games that you used to write up and now both write up in advance but also live tweet, right?
Right, yeah.
So tell us about that. Where did that come from, by the way?
I actually don't remember.
Didn't it start with just Republicans? Debates or no?
I think it might have started with the last debate cycle in 2015-16.
Okay.
And so we started doing that. And so we're going to do it again next week. We're actually going to drink and you can watch. I think it's going to be on live. Right?
Yeah,
so,
on YouTube. We'll put out a link.
We'll put out, you follow us
follow
on Twitter.
Us on Twitter. I'm KT Halps, which is letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. And you are?
At M. Taibbi.
Right. Yeah, that'll be really exciting.
So you can join us next week when we drink ourselves to death on camera.
On Tuesday night, the 15th. 16th of October.
Yeah. So that was Useful Idiots. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, thanks. Bye. Don't forget to rate and review.
right, because we hate Pods of America.
Yes.
Screw those people.
We must crush them.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.